This is WJBC This Week. I'm Andy Dane.
Individuals are locating keys in the vehicles, and then it turns from a vehicle burglary to a stolen vehicle. We've had 9 in the last 30 days.
I want to see a new Iran, and I do believe that the masses in Iran want freedom.
We are kind of oriented towards being a convenience culture, you know, in contrast to, you know, a few decades ago, you know, our parents or grandparents, who, you know, just there was less disposable items available.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we take a look back at the top news stories and interviews from the past week. On this week's program, Bloomington police warn about car theft, Congressman Rodney Davis chimes in on Iran, and McLean County residents continue to recycle. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. I'm Andy Dane. Farmers had a rough summer as rain drenched their fields. Adam Nielsen with the Illinois Farm Bureau says McLean County has received a disaster designation.
This year, certainly, it's rained way beyond what the crop's capacities are and the soil's capacity is to be able to use it, that water effectively. You had a lot of runoff and consequently a lot of crop damage. You can still see it, yellow spots in fields, stunted growth. Soybeans particularly don't like, as they say, wet feet, wet roots, and a lot of the rain came after farmers had planted soybeans and they were in the very early stages of growth, so certainly was a big impact there as well.
And all this has led to low projected crop yields in regards to soybeans, corn, and other things as well, right?
Yeah, last year was a record year, and we were the garden spot of the Midwest. This year we are the rainy spot of the Midwest, and so satellite imagery and what we're hearing from farmers and other people who pay very close attention to production indicate that it's going to be substantially off last year, and even below average. So it certainly is a disaster. It's a widespread disaster. It's going, and farmers are going to be crunched for cash to make payments. Their input costs will be due for next year's crop toward the end of the year, and so this disaster declaration will allow them to apply for low-interest loans, which should be very helpful toward the end of the year.
Now let's talk more about those low-interest loans. We're joined by Adam Nielsen with the Illinois Farm Bureau talking about this disaster designation after all of these heavy rains and flooding that occurred since June 1st. It includes McLean County and pretty much every county besides one. I still haven't seen exactly which one county that is on the press releases that we've gotten. But McLean County is a part of that, surrounding counties as well. Now, what exactly does that disaster designation do in regards, or what does that do for farmers?
Yeah, USDA, it's a secretarial disaster declaration, and so a farmer who is impacted and perhaps in need of a low-interest loan would go to his county FSA office or call them and find out what the procedure would be for applying for that loan. I believe they have 8 months from now to make their loan application and get it into the USDA office. And then from there, the FSA, Farm Service Agency, will determine whether they qualify for that loan, and they'll get their proceeds.
Now, what exactly is the Farm Service Agency, and what's their role in all of this?
It's a division within USDA. USDA is one of the biggest federal agencies. There's numerous departments within USDA, and the FSA is one of them, and the FSA is the arm of the federal USDA that farmers deal with most frequently. They have they work with the FSA offices in their counties.
Up next, students moved back into dorms this week, and ISU Police Chief Aaron Woodruff shared some tips for students with WJBC's Terry James.
They're coming here in August. They don't need to bring all their winter clothes, all their skis and boots and things like that. Most of them are going to go home at some point, at least by Thanksgiving. So if they pack lightly, they'll have a lot easier time getting moved in during this initial week. And then after this week, you know, they'll make trips home. They can bring stuff slowly back and forth and kind of fill their room that way. But, you know, inevitably every year we get somebody that has a U-Haul full of stuff, and it's harder for us to get them into the parking spaces to get them unloaded. And they have to wait in long, long lines just to use the elevators. You think of the 2,000 students living in Waterston Towers and only, you know, six elevators that are servicing them. It makes for a very long day for them, the more stuff they bring.
They kind of pack like they're going to prison. I mean, where the enough stores would be available. I mean, we have stores here where you can buy things.
Oh, I think if you go out to all the stores in town, you'll see the shelves are getting wiped clean, too. So we'll see people make multiple trips throughout the same day. They'll bring the student in. They'll unload the first load. Then they start making their trips to the grocery stores and to the home improvement stores. And so they'll make multiple trips throughout the day.
Why do you need to go to the grocery store when you have a dorm-sized fridge in your dorm? I've never understood this.
Well, apparently you need 20 cases of ramen noodles to pack with you, too, because that's what I see a lot of. There's a lot of ramen noodles, a lot of cases of water, apparently. You know, so, you know, parents every year do the same thing, and certainly the students, you know, initially think they need a lot of things, and they find out, well, my food's pretty much all I need is right here in the dining centers and off-campus places.
Well, let's talk a little more serious subjects. Last year, we did see a few sexual assaults. They're mm-hmm. happening on campus. The good news is that Illinois State University already had Lisa Madigan's recommended policies in place when it comes to preventing sexual assaults. This is something you take very seriously, and I imagine something you speak to parents about.
I talk about it in the preview sessions, which is the orientation. All the students, the new students and transfer students, received an online training program called Consent and Respect. It was part of the alcohol education program, too. So they should have already completed that by this point. All the returning students will now get the training as well, specifically on consent and respect here in the next few weeks. And then in October, we usually send out a crime reporting training to all the faculty and staff at the university, too. So there will be some additional things coming out, education opportunities, bystander intervention training, things that students, faculty, staff can all participate in to try and make the campus safer.
And there were some tips that you gave out last year that I think are great, and if they involve, you know, alcohol use especially is a thing. People do drink, and you don't want to overdo anything. It's everything in moderation. And also being with somebody at all times, not roaming around alone.
Yeah, the bystander piece is a big part of that. So watching out for your friends that you're going out with, at least keeping one of them sober so that they can monitor what's going on with those around them and get them out of harm if they see something happening. Alcohol in and of itself we see used as a facilitator for the sexual assaults. So even though the survivors often didn't think they were going to drink that much, that when somebody keeps handing them drinks and shots and encouraging them to drink more to kind of allow that offense to happen, it makes it a lot tougher. So having somebody there that's sober that can kind of watch out for you is a big key to that. And then also, yeah, the buddy system, walking home too, making sure they're safe getting back to their rooms or their apartments.
The other thing, and I think this applies to residents year-round that live here, because we did have a big problem last year, and we do every year with pedestrians, bicycles, mm-hmm. Learning about the rules of crosswalks. And I want you to speak on that, because we had some serious situations last year. And for those of us that have been here for 3 months with no students, honestly, we've gotten used to not having so many pedestrians around, but it's about to increase pretty big.
Yeah, it's a big shift for us every year, too. I mean, we drive around primarily all day and all night, and when the students leave, we appreciate the fact that we can get through the intersections quicker, and then all of a sudden, it's like a switch, and next thing you know, there's students everywhere, and particularly the first few weeks when students are trying to find their way, they may not be paying attention as much to the traffic signals. And then after a while, students, even if they were paying attention, they just start kind of getting a little more careless, so to speak, where they'll go into the intersections even though they're not supposed to. And so drivers certainly need to be aware of the pedestrians. If they're standing on the corner, there's always a chance someone will just step right out in front of you. So you have to slow down and pay attention and be ready to stop if you need to.
And I can't stress enough to be alert. Don't expect that everyone's going to use the crosswalk or know that they're supposed to. Last year, I had a real scary situation where someone walked. They were standing on a truck in the middle of Main Street, Wesleyan student, and just came out from the truck in the middle of the street, and I slammed on my brakes. And I don't know why they thought that I could see them, but there was no way. You just always have to be thinking there's a kid around the corner who's not following the rules.
Yeah, it's like driving around by a playground. I mean, a ball with a kid chasing after it could always run out in the street. And unfortunately, around college campuses, everywhere around the country, this is a recurring issue. And we know it's an issue. We'll do our best to do some enforcement on it and to educate others, including drivers. But again, it really is incumbent upon everybody to pay attention when they're around campus, because it's just going to happen at some point.
McLean County residents are throwing away more, but they're also recycling more. Michael Brown with the Ecology Action Center sat down with WJBC's Terry James.
We're going to talk about recycling numbers, and you're going to shame me a little bit because I'm going to be honest on the air about my habits. But let's talk about the numbers that were released yesterday. And you feel McLean County's recycling rate remains strong.
Absolutely. So the Ecology Action Center, one of our functions in the community is to promote recycling. Another is to track it and track how much waste is being generated each year and how much of that is being recycled. And so, yes, we've just released the 2014 waste generation and recycling rate, and we're excited to see that, you know, in comparison to 2013, when we actually reached an all-time high recycling rate of 37.7%, we're actually matching that for 2014. So really no change in that percentage rate. We're staying strong. We got some good things going on. People are participating in recycling programs, and so we're getting very close to our community-wide goal of 40% of our waste recycled.
Well, even going back to 2009, you know, all those years ago, this seems to have been an area where people were excited or at least willing to participate in recycling programs.
Absolutely. But even since that time, you know, things have changed, improved. You know, both Bloomington and Normal both now offer, you know, curbside single stream recycling, which makes things more convenient for people to participate. Therefore, you know, increasing participation, increasing total amount recycled. We have other new recycling programs that continue to evolve and grow in the community. You know, non-traditional recycling, we call these, as far as, you know, textile recycling, clothing, shoes, old towels and sheets collected by places like Home Sweet Home Ministries. E-waste recycling, old electronics continues to grow. We now have construction and demolition recycling available in the community. So there's more and more options for people to do the right thing and help, you know, all of us conserve resources.
All right, on the chart here, what does MSW mean?
MSW, municipal solid waste. So that's the technical term for all this stuff that we throw in the trash or preferably throw in the recycling.
Now, we've stayed at this consistent rate, 37.7% of recycling for the last 2 years. The only problems with these numbers are we're seeing an increase in the amount of stuff that we're putting out the door. I mean, we're recycling more. We're also putting more in the landfill, though.
Sure.
What can we do to improve that situation?
Well, that's kind of a bigger cultural shift. And to step back just a few years, in 2012, we saw a significant drop in total waste generated. We were down to 183,000 tons of total waste generated for that year, which that was kind of, you know, a symptom of the economic recession and essentially less disposable income on the part of local residents, buying less, therefore throwing less away. Well, we have seen recovery from that recession. You know, there's still improvement, you know, to be gained. But as people do, again, have more disposable income, they're buying more disposable, more single-use items, less durable goods. and so there's more going in the trash. And part of this is just, you know, our current, you know, culture, and that we are kind of oriented towards being a convenience culture, you know, in contrast to, you know, a few decades ago, you know, our parents, our grandparents, who, you know, just there was less disposable items available, and we were focused more, you know, on you know, home cooking and just more durable appliances. You know, you look nowadays at your electronics or even your clothes washer and things just aren't built like they used to. And so there's more waste being generated, you know, by all of us on a regular basis.
All right, Michael, here's how I do things. I think I'm doing a couple good things. At home, I call it my water cup, because I've got an insulated mug that I'll use and I'll fill up with, you know, lemonade, water, whatever else I'm drinking, soda. And at work, I do have a coffee container that I use. It's plastic, but it's, you know, the hard plastic, sure. So it's washed. But on the other side, I do not recycle, except paper here. Mm-hmm. I know. I buy paper plates. Mm-hmm. I buy red Solo cups.
Sure.
And I throw all that away. And my main meals as a single guy consist of Lean Pockets. So I'm producing more, hopefully not one of those extra tons that we're putting in the in there, but I guess the convenience lifestyle that I'm living, that does contribute to the problem.
It does. And so, you know, I know that, you know, there's not necessarily, there's gaps in some of our services. And so, you know, people living in apartment buildings in our community, you know, there often isn't, you know, easy recycling available to those residents. While there is the drop-offs that still exist in the town of Normal that are open to any local resident to use, you know, they take a little more effort than a curbside program. And so that's something that we all need to work on. But yeah, just looking at our own impacts, looking at, you know, what choices we can make, how can we all individually, you know, try and do a little bit better? We don't all have to be, you know, radical tree huggers in order to make a difference. And so, you know, just those Solo cups alone, you know, to replace one of those, or not one of those, replace all of those,
yeah,
with one durable, reusable cup that you use on a regular basis, you know, right there, even considering, you know, washing that on a regular basis, still there's going to be less resources expended for that than all those disposables. And so little changes like that may be subtle, can have, you know, big results over the long term.
And I'm thinking about college students, and even back when I was in college, of course, you're the drinking age if you do drink. Mm-hmm. And people I've seen at the liquor store, they'll buy those big 30 packs of aluminum cans full of beer. Why not, especially when the parents are in town this week to help the kids move back in, why not just get an extra garbage can?
Absolutely.
And make that for your beer cans or your pop cans or whatever else? And start little. Start with that. Because that alone, if you take all of the beer consumed in Bloomington Normal by college students, or any college town, I'm not just picking on Bloomington Normal, you could probably make a big difference on this number and knock us up a point next year.
Absolutely. And aluminum is such an excellent example. I mean, it is infinitely recyclable. It does, you know, generally have value to it, you know, as opposed to a lot of the other commodities and materials that fluctuate greatly. Aluminum, always, you're going to get something back for it. And so, and it is a good, versatile, you know, material and container. You know, just looking at the bigger picture, you know, costs of transporting beer, say in glass bottles versus aluminum. You know, even a lot of the craft breweries are now going back towards aluminum cans. They are more cost effective in that they're lighter to ship. You can, you know, put more of them in a truck, and so there's all sorts of benefits.
More is coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. I'm Andy Dane. Car thefts continue to take place in the Twin Cities. WJBC's Susan Saunders spoke with Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner and spokeswoman Sarah Mayer.
All right, other big questions we've got for the Bloomington Police Department, and those include stolen vehicles in the news. We've had a lot of stolen vehicles. Sarah, what's the reason that it's so easy? Have we got hot wire experts?
The majority of the time, it's individuals are locating keys in the vehicles, and then it turns from a vehicle burglary to a stolen vehicle. We've had 9 in the last 30 days. The last arrest with the stolen vehicle, we did have 4 juveniles arrested. They were all taken to the juvenile detention center. But I did want to give a shout-out. It was on third shift, and the subjects in the stolen vehicle saw the officer, and they all bailed out, and the vehicle was still rolling. And the officer was heads up. He ran, jumped in the vehicle, and got it stopped before it crashed into any houses. So good job on third shift.
My goodness. I didn't think about that being, you know, stopping the vehicle. But if it's not your vehicle. Now, wait a minute. Going back to the difference between a stolen vehicle and a vehicle. What was the other term?
Burglary.
Burglary. If I've been the dummy who's left my keys in the car, then the charges are less?
No. Typically what's happening is we've had some juveniles checking vehicles for loose change, whatever they can take, basically. So the vehicles were left unlocked, or maybe they've seen valuables inside and forced entry into the vehicle, broken a window. That's not usually as prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So they've started the vehicle burglary, and then they find the keys. And then it turns into a stolen vehicle because they actually take the vehicle for a joyride.
Uh-huh. What happens, Chief Hefner, when you find my vehicle? Let's say my vehicle was stolen. Does it have to stay in police custody as evidence, or will I get it back?
You'll get it back, but we're going to look at it for damage. We're going to look at also for evidence. Sometimes there may be fingerprints that we can glean from there. You know, obviously we're going to look at the contents of it, but we're going to try to process it and get it back to you as soon as possible.
Out of all the stolen vehicles in the Bloomington area, approximately what percentage of vehicles are actually recovered? Is it more than 50%?
Lately, yes, because as Sarah said, that we have some juveniles that
they were on a spree.
We've made some arrests, numerous arrests here over the last few months, and juveniles talk. And so
that's turned.
They're joyriding. We're getting some of them back within hours, a day, a couple days. So we recovered more than 50% of the vehicles. And I don't think that many have been severely damaged, but it would definitely help if people would just take their keys with them.
I've also seen a large number of burglary reports lately where people are popping out panes of glass in patio doors and breaking in. Is that another case where we have done something wrong and attracted a burglar, or is there any good deterrence you can offer us to prevent a residential burglary?
Well, sometimes, and maybe your home looks like an easy target, but sometimes it's just a matter of chance, and they pick your home, and you don't exactly know why. Any good rule of thumb, obviously, with the warmer weather, people have their windows open, so you need to take security measures at night, lock them up, or if you're going to leave, you need to lock those windows. Don't leave them open, because that's an easy way for forced entry. If you're going to be gone, if you have a neighbor you can trust or someone to check on your house, clearly you don't want the newspapers piling up, mm-hmm. or it looked like no one's home. And then also, we tell people, let's say, you know, birthday, holiday, whatever, you get a new big screen TV or something, you know, pretty awesome like that, then you put it out on your curb, the box. Well, you've just told now the burglar, hey, look what's in my home. And TVs are a popular item stolen during residential burglaries.
But if you then report that you've had stolen items, then those people try and pawn them, then if the pawn shop recovers it, you get your item back. Who acts faster? Does the police department send out a report to the pawn shops, hey, look for these items that were reported as stolen? Or should we also call the pawn shops if I've had, let's say, a truck emptied of tools that were very valuable? Who should call?
A combination thereof.
And
obviously,
make it happen?
We take the report so we have the information. When we do that, the officers typically send down a note to all the sworn officers working. So if they run across a person with those items, it can be reported, but we also get the reports from the pawn shop. So a good combination. One thing I would like to reiterate as far as what Sarah said, it is summer.
Mm-hmm.
Burglars know people go on vacation. So the more you can do, as he stated, in regards to lighting and making your home look livable and not an easy target, it helps a lot. But I don't find it a coincidence that we have had some recently because it is summer, and they do understand that.
WJBC's Scott Laughlin spoke with Illinois' 13th District Congressman Rodney Davis. Davis spoke about President Obama's plan for Iran.
Well, you know what? No one wants to be in Washington, D.C. in August. It's just hotter than blazes. But so what? We know you work in 365. There's no time off. What do you do when you come back with this whole month off? What are the plans for you?
We were in Decatur and Champaign all day yesterday doing meetings and events. Got a chance to talk to some SCORE mentors, former business leaders that mentor young entrepreneurs. Got a chance to go out and see a new company that's moving into Decatur, do their job fair. They're hiring 300 people in Decatur yesterday at Richland Community College. Great opportunities there. And then up to Champaign for a few different events and individual meetings. And we're going to be doing the same down in the southwest portion of the district tomorrow. And it's just a lot of travel. I've got 14 counties in the district, and it just takes a lot of time to be able to get there and also talk to the folks who may have an issue with the federal government.
There are a few of those out there. What are the? Is there a theme? Is there one thing you're hearing over and over and over again from your constituents?
You know, not really. Really a lot of individual issues, a lot of individual issues with legislation, individual issues with trying to break through the bureaucracy of Washington. You know, and that's really the biggest part of the job. We sometimes have to go from one subject to another and do it, hopefully seamlessly. But, it just makes me laugh when they say a do-nothing Congress when we've actually passed more bills out of the House than we have in a few decades in the same time. As a matter of fact, the Hire More Heroes Act that you and I have talked about was actually signed into law by the president just a week and a half ago.
Hey, were you there for that signing?
No, he didn't invite me.
Are you kidding me? I thought you spearheaded that. I thought you were one of the big players in that.
I was a big player. We got the language inserted into another larger bill, and the Senate didn't pass their version of it until after we had already left for our August district work period.
All right. Has anybody, when you're back, are people talking about the Iranian nuclear deal? Is the Midwest talking to you about that? Do they have questions about that, or is that not even on their radar?
No, it's on some folks' radar. I mean, it's not an overwhelming amount of people that talk to me about it, Scott, but it's an issue that's important to some and an issue I think important to many. I'm opposed to the deal. I think it's a bad deal for America. I think we're letting Iran still develop ICBM technology. They don't need ICBM technology to be able to possibly put a nuclear warhead on there.
So you don't like the idea. And just, was it yesterday, you had 36 retired generals and admirals in an open letter supporting this nuclear deal. Have you had a chance to talk to anyone at the Pentagon and military to get their take on this?
I've had a classified briefing with some of the top leaders who are in charge of negotiating this. And obviously, I can't get into the detailed information, but what I can tell you is I found it somewhat interesting that Secretary Kerry would answer one question and seemingly contradict himself in answering the next. That didn't make me too comfortable that this was anything other than an attempt by this administration to leave a legacy that would actually make people think that the president actually earned his Nobel Peace Prize that he received before he was even sworn in.
So what's the alternative then?
The alternative is more sanctions. The alternative is ensuring that the minority radical Islamic government that rules Tehran and rules Iran and funds terrorist organizations throughout this globe, to make sure that they are given an opportunity to leave power. I want to see a new Iran, and I do believe that the masses in Iran want freedom. This governing body, led by these radical Islamic leaders, they continue to tout death is touted, and the 10 rallies that were chants of death to Israel and death to America are prevalent. These are not the type of people that are going to live up to any agreement, no matter what the piece of paper says.
But the question then is, what is the alternative?
Just mean he said more sanctions.
Just more sanctions?
Yeah, the alternative is more sanctions, continuing to do what we're doing. All we have to do is look around to the neighbors of Iran, and all of the neighbors around Iran, even our allies, are opposed to this deal. I think that says something.
Let's switch gears a little bit, and Hillary Clinton this week unveiled a new proposal to help reduce college loans and the amount that students are having to pay.
She has your daughter
to
in
pay
mind.
Off those loans, and essentially, she would pay for it. It's about $350 billion over 10 years. And it would include some refinancing options for those who already have the debt, as well as providing some flow-through money to states that agree to increase funding for higher education. And she's going to pay for it by changing some of the tax code as it applies to wealthy individuals. Have you looked at this proposal? Have you heard about it? And what do you think about it? Because the Congress would have to approve it, and we know it's Republican-led. Would this have any chance?
Colleen is assuming she's going to win.
I'm just saying, because some analysts are saying that it could get some bipartisan support.
Well, I think many of the ideas that Secretary Clinton has laid out could get bipartisan support. That's the plan that I've seen reported, and I've only read the reports. I haven't seen a detailed plan, and always, it's always with everything in Washington, the devil's in the details. But I'm glad that the Secretary has decided to make this an issue. This is an issue that I've talked about in my last campaign. My daughter did a commercial talking about how we're trying to address higher ed costs, and I'm glad that the plan that she's throwing out there doesn't just address student loans and those who have graduated, because the key is, how do you lower the cost of college? How do you make sure that when we raise Pell Grants in Washington, that tuition doesn't go up to eat that Pell Grant away for the families that rely on it? And I'm glad that she's decided to make this a priority. It's one of my priorities. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys are aware or not, but I'm one of 8 members of Congress that have been appointed to a White House Advisory Council, bipartisan, for Republicans, for Democrats, that are working with the White House to address some of these same issues that we're talking about. And in a district like mine that includes 4 public universities, 4 private universities, 8 community college districts, many specialty colleges, I'm honored that I can work in a bipartisan fashion to try and address many of these issues, and I hope we can do it even before the next presidential election.
So would you say that Clinton plan is a place to start, or where do you start as an advisory committee?
Well, we're already discussing many of these issues with the White House and in a bipartisan fashion with many folks in Congress. So the issues of the cost of higher ed, the issues of ensuring that these students aren't graduating with debt that they can never pay for, making sure that college is more affordable, not only at the community college level, but at the university level and the grad school level. So I'm glad that she's entering the debate. And I think anytime any politician running for president talks about higher education, I would say that, you know, that's a great starting point.
Do you think colleges and universities have cut enough?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to know how they run their operations and determine what their cuts are. I know they've been devastated by the lack of state funding that have been traditionally coming to our universities. I still believe that colleges can be able to ensure that the Pell Grants that students and families get and deserve can go further. And that's a message that every time I visit president of any of the colleges or any of the administrators, I continue to talk about, because I will tell you, many of the colleges aren't too shy to come ask for federal help. And I always turn around and ask, what are you doing to make sure your tuition is affordable so that students in Illinois
aren't seeing state schools that aren't in Illinois compete against those schools that are here.
And do you like the answers you get?
I like some of the answers I get, but obviously, just bringing up the message, I hope will ensure that they know that many families are looking at the cost of college. I mean, look, I've got a lot of friends whose kids have graduated just the last couple of years, and I find it ironic that many state schools in Illinois compete with the University of Missouri when it comes to cost. We're losing some of our best and brightest students because of the ever-increasing cost of college here in Illinois versus other states. And we have to figure out what other states are doing right, and we may need to mimic that.
The Week in News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Week in News. Here's Terry James.
The American Public Transportation Association has recognized Connect Transit as the 2015 Outstanding Public Transportation System for agencies providing fewer than 4 million annual rides. General Manager Andrews Johnson says the company is honored to receive this recognition.
Without the commitment of our community, the loyalty of our customers, the leadership of our elected officials, the vision of our Board of Trustees, and the hard work of our dedicated employees, this award would not have been possible.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner calls the progress the company has made tremendous. Bloomington Normal is busy again with students as college classes get underway. Illinois State University Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says college freshmen and their parents should take his advice.
Pack lightly. Don't take everything you own. You can buy stuff after you get there. But really, every university and college is going through the same thing. They're trying to cram a lot of people into a small space all at once.
The flamingo exhibit at Miller Park Zoo was given the green light from the Bloomington City Council. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says the $233,000 project was met with some opposition.
Alderman Kevin Lauer voted against the proposal.
I still have a hard time accepting the fact that we're going to do this without taking care of a number of other priorities first. I think we've gotten the cart before the horse.
Alderwoman Amelia Burgess, while voting for a $735,000 project at the water treatment plant, says the council has a good grasp on needs versus wants.
On the same night that we have now voted to support a quality of life institution here in town, the zoo, at a price of $150,000, we're spending substantially more on our infrastructure.
The Miller Park Zoological Society and the Ewing Zoo Foundation are putting $153,000 into the exhibit. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
A Tazewell County Sheriff's deputy died after a single car crash while responding to a call. Tazewell County Sheriff Robert Houston says 44-year-old Deputy Craig Wisenin was responding to a report of a domestic disturbance in Armington at about 10:30 Monday night, and communications with the officer were lost a short time later. Another deputy discovered the accident just before midnight. Wisenin was pronounced dead at the scene. State police and the coroner's office are investigating. Bloomington City Manager David Hales says final recommendations from the city's budget task force will likely come next month. The group is trying to figure out how to fill an expected gap of $7 million in next year's budget.
There continued to be some support for about 0.25% sales tax increase on the revenue side.
In the city of Bloomington, naming a new city water director, Robert Yale. Yale has worked with Bloomington since 2013 as assistant city engineer. He says he doesn't have a specific agenda as he prepares to take over the position.
I look forward to working with the staff that's been in place for years within the water department, working with them to determine what those priorities are and trying to push forward and provide the great services, continue the great services they have done.
Hale says he is confident Yale is prepared to lead the water department. Yale will officially begin his new job September 8th. Unit 5's Board of Education got a look Wednesday at the district's tentative fiscal year 2015-2016 budget. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports the overall budget is balanced and worth a total of $150 million.
The education fund makes up the majority of the budget and is expected to show a surplus of roughly $500,000. Finance Director Marty Hickman says finding a balanced budget isn't easy.
It's extremely difficult. Many of the variables, especially on the revenue side, are not known until very late into the actual
budget period. So things can change, as we learned this past year in March when the governor cut the budget.
Transportation funds expected to show a deficit of $2.2 million, which Hickman says is due in part to a structural deficit in that fund. The school board will vote on the budget in September. Adam Staszynski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
District 87 will operate in the red again next year. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says the district's anticipated deficit is $1.4 million.
The school board will vote on the budget September 23rd after a public hearing. Superintendent Barry Riley says there's still enough money in reserves to cover the deficit and any curveballs the state might throw at schools.
If there were something that were to pass that causes an immediate impact, which the likelihood of that is not very strong, I would say, we do have those fund reserves to deal with that. And again, we'll continue to monitor our spending and bring that down as best we can over time.
Riley says there are issues beyond this year the district has to worry about, like a potential change to the school funding formula and the potential of schools having to pay more for teacher pensions. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
With a look at this week's news, I'm Terry James.
Up next, a preview of the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time now to take a look at the week to come. Ground will be broken for the flamingo exhibit at the Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington on Monday. The Bloomington Committee of the Whole and Normal Town Council meet Monday as well. On Tuesday, the Harlan Community College Board will meet. Carrie Mueling will be broadcasting from the Illinois State Fair, and our Brian Bloodworth will start his countdown to kickoff reports with Illinois State, Illinois Wesleyan, and high school football just around the corner. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. Thanks for listening. I'm Andy Dane.